Namastubhyam Bhagavate Purushaya Mahatmane Buddha Avasaya Bhutya Paraya Paramatmane Namastubhyam Bhagavate Purushaya Mahatmane Bhutavasaya Bhutaya Paraya Paramatmane Namastubhyam Bhagavate Purushaya Mahatmane Bhutavasaya Bhutaya Paraya Paramatmane Namaha. Obeisances to Bhyam, to you, Bhagavate, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Purushaya, who is present within as the Supersoul, Mahatmane, who are all pervasive, Bhuta Avasaya, who are the shelter of all material elements, beginning with the ethereal sky. Bhutaya, who exist even prior to the creation. Paraya, to the supreme cause. Paramatmane, who are beyond all material cause. Translation, we offer our obeisances unto you, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Although present in the hearts of all living beings as the Supersoul, you are all pervasive. Although the original shelter of all created material elements, you exist prior to their creation. And although the cause of everything, you are transcendental to all material cause and effect, being the Supreme Soul. Report, the beautiful Sanskrit poetry of this verse should be chanted out loud for the pleasure of the reciter and the hearer. That's the end of the purport. So we'll also read text 40. Obeisances unto you, the absolute truth, for the reservoir of all transcendental consciousness and potency, and the possessor of unlimited energies, although completely free of material qualities and transformations, you are the prime mover of the material, of material nature. Those who consider themselves intellectual, philosophic, I don't know why I didn't say philosophical, philosophic or rational, these purports are not by Prabhupada, it's by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada, so I don't. Someone that knows, someone here would like to volunteer to write a letter to Dravida and point out they might want to edit philosophic. Or rational should carefully note here that the absolute truth, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is the ocean of all knowledge and consciousness. Thus, surrendering unto the Supreme Lord does not entail giving up the method of rationally comprehending reality Rather, one merges into the ocean of rational, logical comprehension. The Supreme Lord is the perfection of all sciences and all forms of knowledge, and only envious and trivial minds would deny this obvious fact. Is there anyone here who is not familiar with this section and needs a little background? Everyone's familiar with this section. Who's speaking? Huh? Okay. Let me see a show of hands of who doesn't know who's speaking. Okay. Thank you. The title is the chapter, Krishna Chastises the Serpent Kaliya. And Kaliya is, long story, how he became a serpent. It has to do with a long history of, in a previous lifetime, he was a sage who was envious. He was cursed by another sage because of his envy, and he became a serpent because serpents are known to be envious. They bite even without provocation, poisonous ones. So Kaliya took shelter in a lake formed by the river Jamuna. So rivers sometimes have lakes, that is, bodies of water that are coming from the flow of the river water. But over here is a low piece of land, and so water collects over here, and it's called the lake. Not all lakes are like that, but this lake was like that. Interesting story. Very interesting story. Kaliya had become a snake, and he was living in some remote place. Many people attribute that remote place was the Fiji Islands, somewhere over there. And the name of the place is given in Sanskrit. And Garuda, who's Vishnu's bird carrier, Garuda would come to that place where there are many snakes and come and... So they made a deal with, like, a truce with Garuda. On a regular fixed time schedule, they'd make certain offerings to Garuda, and he could come and take those offerings without killing all the serpents. So they took turns making the offerings, and when it was Kaliya's turn, instead of offering to Garuda, he ate it himself because he was envious. Although he, in his previous life, had been envious, he didn't lose that enviousness when he became a serpent. And so Garuda, recognizing that Kaliya had taken the offering that was meant for him, came swooping in on Kaliya. And Kaliya took shelter of, I forget who, maybe the ocean personified, Sumudra, and Samudra, and he was advised, you go to a certain place where Garuda won't go, and you're safe. And that certain place is this lake. And the reason that Garuda won't go there is, long story, Sobari Muni was doing his meditation underwater at that place, and Garuda came and he cursed him because Garuda was wanting some fish, and he, you know, you're disturbing my meditation. If you come again, you're finished. You're dead. So Garuda won't go there. Go there and you're okay. Garuda won't harm you. So he went there. And he stayed there a long time. And as he was staying there a long time, because he was envious, it was poison coming from his body, I guess, or his mouth or something. And the lake became very, very poisonous. The Kaliya Lake became so poisonous that vegetation surrounding the boundary of the lake all died. Birds that flew over the lake, they would die because of the fumes were so poisonous. Bad scene in Vrindavan. Krishna wanted to correct that bad scene, so he arranged a pastime. That morning, instead of Krishna accompanying the cowherd boys like they do every day, the cows went and made a beeline for the Kaliya Lake, straight from Nandagram. And those of you that have been in Vrindavan, Nandagram is quite a distance from Kaliya Lake. Or now there's no lake, it's the Kaliya Ghat, very near to the Krishna Balaram temple. Any case, they just went straight there and started drinking water. The cows drank water and keeled over as if dead. And the cowherd boys drank water and they keeled over as if dead. And then Krishna came, because he came a little late that morning by Leela plan. And Balaram wasn't there. Balaram was back in the underground for some reason. Doesn't say why. And when Krishna saw the scene of the cows and the cowherd boys looking as if dead, he was, for a moment, overwhelmed by his own yogamaya potency, and then that yogamaya potency, by his will, was withdrawn, and he knew exactly what to do. He glanced over the cows and cowherd boys, and they came back to life. He challenged the Kaliya serpent. He got up this kadamba tree, tightened his cloth, and plunged into the Kaliya Lake with such force, like heavier than the whole universe. The Kaliya Lake went all over the side, the shore of the lake, and Krishna was jumping around and splashing, and Kaliya, they came really agitated. Who has come to my lake? So he surfaced and captured Krishna. Those few things happened. He captured Krishna in his coils. Many things happened in between. But he captured Krishna in his coils, and the cowherd boys, seeing Krishna in danger, usually it's a role reversal. Usually the cowherd boys are in danger and they call for Krishna. This is one where Krishna's in danger. What were they going to call? They practically died. Somebody ran back to Nandagram real fast. Nanda Maharaj, Mother Jasoda. Krishna's in danger. Balaram said, don't worry, it's just a pastime. He's just having fun. And they said, no, we have to go immediately and protect Krishna. So they had some scene happened on the shore. Balaram had to stop Mother Jasoda from entering the river Jamuna to give up her life if Krishna's in trouble. It worked. She stopped. Balaram, very strong. And then Krishna decided to escape the coils of Kaliya. He got himself big and really big and really big, one of his mystic cities. Kaliya is a serpent, so his body expanded and expanded. And then all of a sudden Krishna became very small again. And he escaped out of the coils and started dancing on the hoods of the Kaliya serpent. And as he was dancing, he was showing his skill of dancing because he had many, many hoods, and he's dancing from one hood, the other hood, and dancing, like a real spectacle. The demigods are playing music. Watch Krishna dance. Woo, woo, woo. But his feet, being as heavy as the universe, were smashing the hood of the Kaliya serpent. His body came completely mangled. His hoods became completely mangled. And then the wives of the Kaliya serpent, they came out of the water with folded palms, the Naga Patnis, as we heard. Naga Patnis, the wives of the Naga, the serpent, wives of Kaliya serpent. They began offering beautiful, very eloquent prayers to the personality of Godhead Krishna. And that's what this section is. The Naga Patnis offering prayers, very celebrated prayers, just as this one sentence purport says, this beautiful Sanskrit poetry should be chanted out loud. So it's chanted out loud because, well, it's purifying, but it doesn't say purifying. It says it's very pleasing. But things that are purifying are transcendentally pleasing at the same time for both the chanter and the hearer, the reciter, the one who's hearing the recitation. And so I'd like to say something about this verse and the next verse. Several things. One of the Srimad Bhagavatam, one of the many things it is, the Srimad Bhagavatam is a commentary on Vedanta Sutra. The whole of Srimad Bhagavatam was compiled by Vyas, who compiled Vedanta Sutra. And Vedanta Sutra is difficult to understand. Little sayings, sutras, that are perplexing. And how are you going to understand something that's perplexing? Well, if you're a speculator, you just speculate. That's what you do. And it's not possible to understand anything by speculation, certainly not Vedanta Sutra by speculation. And so it's explaining Vedanta Sutra. And there are many statements in Vedanta Sutra, because they're sutras, they don't give the detail of Krishna being the source of everything, but Krishna, who is the source of everything, is literally the source of everything. Like somebody who's another part of the world, they wrote to me yesterday about they're studying Bhakti Shastri and they're being trained to become a Bhakti Shastri teacher, and there are several passages in Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says things like of gamblers, of gambling, I am a cheat, I am the cheat, or something like that. I'm cheats, I am gambler. So, hey, how, you know, bad stuff comes from Krishna. Good stuff, yes, why bad stuff? And then another reference, chapter 10, text number 5, Prabhupada explicitly says in the purport, both bad and good come from Krishna. So how can bad come from the all good? It's a classic. You know, God is all good, God is all great, why did he create a place that people are suffering? You know that one. It's a classic. Because he could have created a place where people don't suffer. So why did he create a place of people suffering? Not fair. It's like, you know, scolding Krishna or something. He made a boo-boo. How can God make a boo-boo? Because he's infallible. Must be no God. And people become atheists because of that. Some people. So it's a perplexing situation. How to understand that which is the source of everything? Well, that's Vedanta Sutra. That's the first aphorism. The absolute truth is that from which everything emanates, and everything means everything. So how do you break down the everything? Well, let's just take one of these statements here. The first one. We, this is the wives of Kaliya Serpent, offer our obeisances unto you, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Although present in the hearts of all living beings at the Supersoul, you are all pervasive. Although in one place, you're everywhere. Now, we can't be in one place and everywhere. We can't be everywhere either. We can be in one place, but we can't be everywhere. But Krishna is everywhere in multiple ways, not even just one way. And that leads into the next statement. So, but as a Supersoul, Paramatmane, Purushaya, Mahatmane, Mahatma, translation here is all pervasive. As the Supersoul, he's all pervasive. Well, it's the same Supersoul that's within the heart of every living being, and it's the same Paramatma that's within every atom. And within the created realm, Vishnu is everywhere, just like Prahlad said to his father. Where is this Vishnu? He's everywhere. Is he in this pillar? He's in the pillar. If he's everywhere, he's in the pillar. Although he's a super soul within the heart of every being, he's all pervasive. And he's all pervasive by his Brahman feature, and he's all pervasive by the expansion of his energies in the material creation. Where is there not material energy? Say it positively. Everywhere there's the material energy. Say it differently. There's no void in the creation of God. Void would mean where there's nothing. There's no void in the creation of God. There's always something. And that something, minimally, is Krishna's energy. Just like it says in the word for word, beginning with the ethereal sky. It's pretty, you know, pun intended, it's pretty elementary. In eighth grade science, I remember my science teacher put on the front, he had a big front desk, you know, a laboratory type of desk, a big, thick, 1-inch thick black, whatever his stuff is made of, marble or something. Put a bell jar on the desk, said, what's inside? The bell jar. We were being introduced to a bell jar. So, you know, some people said nothing because it's just empty. He said, no, there's air and there's water and there's little particles. So then he hooked up a vacuum pump to the bell jar. It was really noisy and pumped all the stuff out. The water, the air, the little particles, dust or whatever. And said, okay, now what's inside? And you're supposed to say nothing. It's a vacuum, because he created a vacuum with a vacuum pump. But there is something. One of the elements, Akash. There's no void or even vacuum, because vacuum means there's nothing. Vacuum in that sense, in the creation of God, there's always something. And there's the opportunity by Krishna's arrangement to withdraw all of that. But even then, that when he withdraws all of that, the material elements are withdrawn. But then there's that in which the material elements are floating or situated, and that's Brahman. Brahma Jyoti. Hey, we're in the Brahma Jyoti right now. We don't see it. We're not aware of it, consciousness-wise, but that's all pervasive too. Like, where is there not Brahman? It's all pervasive. So by his energies, he's all pervasive. By his Brahman feature, he's all pervasive. By his Paramatma feature, within material creation, he's all pervasive. Hiranyakashipu didn't get it. And most people don't get it. And if they say he's all pervasive, then it's just one thing, it's just Brahman. And then they say, you know, this is Mayavadis. What is matter? It doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. Jagat mithya. This doesn't exist. Poof. By word jugglery, it just doesn't exist. It exists. If it doesn't exist, let me hit you over the head with this baseball bat and you tell me it doesn't exist. If it doesn't exist, then give me all your money because it doesn't exist. It's all one, right? Etc. It's a philosophy that people don't live by, but they say it anyways. It's cheating. The emperor has no clothes. So, it's apparent, there are apparent contradictions in Vedanta Sutra or in understanding that which from which everything comes. There are apparent contradictions, but there's no contradictions. There are apparent contradictions, but there are no contradictions. Apparent contradiction because our mind is very tiny and binary, and we can't comprehend what's beyond the tiny binary mind because it's inconceivable. Because it's inconceivable doesn't mean it's false, like there's no Bhagavan, or there's no Paramatma, or there's no Atma. There's no material elements. There's nothing except Brahman. That's if, you know, if you have a tiny brain and you can't understand what's beyond your tiny brain. You can't understand Vedanta Sutra without the assistance of the Bhagavatam in disciplic succession to explain it. Even us, to understand this, we require disciplic succession to explain it, although it's an explanation of Vedanta Sutra. Next. That was the first two verses here. Bhuta avasaya. He's the shelter of the material elements. Bhutaya, who exists prior to the material elements. And that's not so apparently contradictory, but there's the manifest, the unmanifest, manifest, unmanifest. From Krishna, who the wives of the Kaliya serpent are addressing, you're the shelter of the material elements, but you exist before the material elements, meaning before the creation of, or demonstrated by the material elements. You're the shelter of those elements, and you exist before the elements and before the creation. Although the cause of everything, you are transcendental to all material cause and effect. Just like Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, I created this system, Chaturvarna Maya Srishtam, Guna Karma Vibhagasha. There's so many examples, but there's one. He creates the social structure of creation. And then he says, but I'm the non-creator. I'm the non-doer. Because everything's being carried out by his material energy. But how does the material energy carry out whatever the material energy carries out? Under his direction, like remote control. It doesn't even have to have a control system, like drones. It's very interesting. During the one festival in Mayapur, big festival, they were putting the domes up on the top of the Mayapur temple. There were three domes. Big crane lifting, and then so flying around was a drone taking pictures of the crowd and taking pictures of the crane lifting the dome, and then slowly the dome being lowered and the kirtan going wild. And but I was watching this drone, you know, the drone doesn't fly on its own, there's somebody over there with the controls. drones don't fly on their own. Although it looks like it's just like it's remote control. It's war technology being used for some commercial purposes now. It takes an operator to make the drone work. It takes an operator to make anything work. The whole of material creation is not happening by chance or something like that. Because they can't see the remote controller doesn't mean it's operating without remote control. Krishna doesn't have to do anything. He's the non-doer, and yet he does stuff. He does stuff through the agency of his energies, and he just desires X, and X happens. That's all he does, Icha. Desire. He wills it. And voila. There's lots of details and details and details. So what the Old Testament says, what Genesis says, God said, he didn't even have to say it. God said, let there be light. And there was, and it was good. I mean, there's many, many steps in between which Sankhya philosophy describes, but he's the remote controller. Even bad stuff, he's the remote controller. He doesn't wish it, but the whole of creation has duality, has good and bad. It's just the nature of the place. It's for people who are rebellious. Like the state has a prison house because they end up thinking, hey, I got a great idea. What's that? Let's develop a state and build prisons. I'm really into it. Let's build prisons. So we'll get a state going and we can build a prison. It's not the purpose of the prison, not the purpose of the state, but there are people who rebel and bring harm to others, so they need a place. That's what a prison is, a place for rebellious people. And in the rebellious people place, there's pain and misery. It's not meant to be a nice place. It's to teach the prisoners, don't be rebellious. There's consequences that you don't like. That's one of the reasons why there's bad stuff that happens, because people are rebellious. And it's to teach them otherwise. Because some people, they need a stick in order to sit straight. And still they don't sit straight because they're rebellious. The dark mode of ignorance has really got them. Even when they're shown a stick. Even when the stick whacks them. And that's sanctioned from that which is the source of everything. So the Kaliya serpent's wives, they're smart ladies. They understand Krishna is the source of everything. And it's perplexing very quickly because of time. There are multiple parts of Queen Kunti's prayers, which I really like. I mean, her prayers. But several places, there's 2 or 3 verses and then again, later 2 or 3 verses that say, I'm going to read 2 of them. You're perplexing. No, she's a profound person that understands Krishna, taking the position of one who doesn't understand Krishna. In part because of humility, but she can understand Krishna because of her bhakti. And that's the only way to understand Krishna, not by speculative power, reading Vedanta Sutra and saying this means that. One will not understand Vedanta Sutra or the Bhagavatam that way. Here's 2 of multiple sources in Kunti's prayers that express this contradictory nature of his. This is text 29. O Lord, no one can understand your transcendental pastimes, which appear to be human and are so misleading. You have no specific object of favor, nor do you have any object of envy. People only imagine that you are partial, and there's things that precede that, because he admonishes the miscreants and he protects the devotees with books like partiality. But he's not. Of course it is bewildering, O soul of the universe, that you work, though you are inactive, that you take birth, though you are the vital force and the unborn. You yourself descend amongst animals, men, sages, and aquatics. Verily, this is bewildering. So their features, without understanding the totality of the Bhagavatam's message, that by initial inspection, it's bewildering, it's contradictory, that it has to be that that which is the source of everything is the balance between everything and everything else. There isn't anything that isn't balanced within Krishna, because he's the source of everything, including apparent contradictions, because everything is within him. That's mysterious. It sounds like double talk. And the Upanishads are filled with it. He walks and he does not walk. He's very near and very far away as well. He's within everything and he's outside of everything. Upanishadic double talk. So if you're a speculator, it's homogenized Brahman. And if you're a devotee, you understand how wonderful is Krishna. He has unlimited expansions and unlimited features, and he's the source of all of that. That's him. That's the Bhagavan feature. From which comes the Paramatma feature, who oversees all this duality thing over here. Just by his will, he doesn't get involved. But nothing happens without his sanction. Remote controller. It's his energies moving under his control. And there's only one of a kind. There's not like a competitor God. Like the biblical sense of God and Satan, and there's like this Star Wars clash between the two. No way. Way. It's popular, Star Wars, or God and Satan, and they're having a battle for your mind, and a battle. It's not another personality that's equally powerful, and they're having a struggle. No way. There's one source of everything. It's our misuse of free will that's the struggle, and we struggle indeed. And there's a solution. We take shelter. But shelter of whom? And how? And why? So the Bhagavatam is there for all that reasons. So the text 40, obeisances unto you, the absolute truth, who are the reservoir of all transcendental consciousness and potency and the possessor of unlimited energies, although completely free of material qualities and transformations, you're the prime mover of material nature. So our commentators, Prabhupada's disciples, chose to speak about the speculative process, the intellectuals and philosophic people that want to say this means that. And the Bhagavatam and absolute truth can't be entered that way. It remains a mystery. But it doesn't mean we shut off our intellect and our power of reason. We use them in Krishna's service under proper guidance and direction. And then we're, as it's very nice language here, one enters into this ocean of rational logic comprehension. The Supreme Lord is the perfection of all sciences and all forms of knowledge. I was having this discussion with two devotees who are kind of newer, not like new, but newer to Krishna consciousness. In other words, both of them are PhDs in physics. One over here, one over there. And when they started, their wives are devotees. So they started to what's Krishna consciousness? And it was a struggle because physics teaches this and the Bhagavatam seems to contradict this. It doesn't really contradict this. It's just a higher understanding of this. So, one of the things that helps devotees is to understand exactly this one sentence here. We don't trash knowing things by scientific method. This is a scientific method. We just don't rely on the limits of our mind and intelligence and senses. But we use our mind and intelligence and senses in a higher scientific manner. On authority of the Vedas, for a starter. We reach that conclusion by reason. I was recently in China, and there's this one fellow who he was practically bursting. He wanted to know, he kept asking the same question 10 times. How do I know that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead? And, round and around, but on the authority of the Vedas. My first answer to him, my response, is said, do you accept the authority of your mother? He said, of course I do. Why are you asking? Through a translator. He said, supposing you ask your mother, who is your father? You can accept who is your father on the authority of your mother? I said, of course. Now, supposing your mother lies to you. Well, she's not going to lie to me. She's going to tell me who my father is. Okay, very good. By accepting the authority of your mother, you can know who your father is, and otherwise you can't know who your father is. You can guess. Well, the man has been living in your house for umpteen years, and that's my father. But how do you know? Maybe he's not your father. He's just been living in the house, taking care of the family. Maybe he's not your father. But ask your mother. She's not going to lie to you. And if she lies to you, too bad, because then you're not going to know. I just covered that ground for a while. Okay. Now, what about accepting the authority of the Vedas? We use reason and logic to accept the authority of the Vedas as opposed to the other means of knowing things. Yes? We say, it's very reasonable. Senses are imperfect and reasoning power is imperfect. We use our reasoning power to say they're imperfect. They're imperfect. And using that reasoning power, we say, well, we need another source. What's that other source? A perfect person. The Vedas come from a perfect person. Well, how do you know? That was this man's question. How do you know? On the authority of the Vedas. That's how you know. In other ways, you're not going to know. After 15 minutes of that, he said, I have to think about it. I said, you won't understand by thinking about it. jump in the pool, and you have to understand what water is. You won't know. Bhakti Siddhanta's licking on the jar of honey, you'll never know what sweetness of honey is. By science, you can study. Honey has this refractive index, and da 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 da. It's viscous, viscosity as you pour it. But you don't know what the sweetness of honey is until you put your finger in it. This is Bhakti Siddhanta. So, my dear sir, this is the perplexity of understanding the absolute truth. You have to accept authority. It's right in the beginning part of chapter 10, Bhagavad Gita. You'll never know. You'll never know except one method, through hearing from authority that knows. And otherwise, you'll never know. Well, how do I know I should accept that authority? Look at your other options, and you can say, well, I'm just not going to accept that authority because I don't know. Okay, that's a choice, and then you'll never know. But there is a way to know. Open the jar of honey, put your finger in. Ah, that's what honey tastes like. It's very sweet. That's the one way of knowing. And so the Bhagavatam is explaining, back to the starting point, Vedanta Sutra, which is teaching what is the source of everything. And then there's different features. Sambandha, the relationship of everything with that source, acting in that relationship, and the mature stage. And it's all there in Vedanta Sutra, and it's all there in Srimad Bhagavatam. And you can say, how do I know? You have to accept the authority of the Vedas, which come from a perfect personal, you'll never know. It's a choice, and we all have to make choices. And we're relying upon our capacity. So that's this plunging into the ocean of intellectual and reasonable pursuit of knowing the unknowable. The unknowable becomes knowable. This is earlier verse in Canto 10, Chapter 8. Unknowable becomes knowable. The unconquerable becomes conquered. That's a contradiction. By the bhakti process, he gives himself to such a person, then that person can know. Just like by the eating process, when you've been fasting, your bodily strength returns, your hunger subsides, and you feel full. You won't know what that is until you eat after fasting, then you can know. Otherwise, you won't know. Okay, so that's our discussion for the morning. Let's see if there's some questions.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. Is there any background on why the Nagapatnis are so smart?
No.
How do they know?
There's a principle they have to have heard from someone. But I don't know anywhere that it says from whom they heard. But it's a spiritual principle. Otherwise, not possible.
Maharaj, you were very beautifully explaining this.
Slowly, please.
You were explaining how Krishna contains these contradictory qualities.
Yes.
And you gave various examples. And we see that in these Vrindavan pastimes, Krishna manifests sweetness and opulence simultaneously.
Yeah.
So how is it that the residents of Vrindavan are seeing Krishna dancing on top of a snake and they never think, how is that even possible? Instead, they're just happy that he's okay. You know? How is it that ability to recognize Krishna's opulence is missed, or perhaps they're not even aware of it?
Well, it depends on each viewer of Krishna's opulence. They see differently according to their rasa. And that means the internal potency of Krishna is reciprocating with each of them in order that they can experience his opulence, however, is their relationship with Krishna. It's the function of the internal potency, or the yogamaya potency, or whatever you like, reciprocating with each and every one differently. But, you know, Krishna's lifting of Govardhan Hill. Each of the persons seeing saw differently. Nanda Maharaj in his way, the gopis in their way, cowherd boys in their way. Oh, how wonderful is Krishna. That's like, we don't have to figure it out. How wonderful is Krishna. The sweetness element is experienced differently according to different rasas, and the intelligence is provided according to that rasa, so they can support and maintain that rasa and sweetness. You always have nice questions. You have a nice question this morning? Okay.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. What you said about the difference between certainties and faith. In Colombia, we say that when a mother say, "I am the mother," there's a certainty. And when the father say, "I am the father," that is faith.
Just a cultural similarity.
It's a colloquial way of saying, what is the difference between...
It's how we know. Srila Prabhupada ki?
Aye.